It's Philosophy Talk.
When you sign on to that 28-page document that you didn't read, you are not clicking on the First Amendment. You're clicking on Terms of Service. They're going to define what you can say and what you cannot.
What are the biggest challenges facing activists in the digital age?
What's private, what's public, and who decides?
Can we use digital tools to organize politically while also protecting our privacy?
Folks who are telling us that privacy is over have a vested interest in telling us that privacy is over.
How has the internet changed the way we engage in civil society?
What is a hashtag anyway?
Technology, I think, is a good thing. I think we've learned some pretty bad habits.
Our guest is Lucy Bernholz, co-author of Disrupting Philanthropy, Technology, and the Future of the Social Sector.
The access to the internet and mobile and digital technologies at least gives all of us a chance to get in there.
Cyber activism, coming up.
Hashtag Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner. That's on the Stanford University campus. Ken teaches philosophy there, and I did for 40 years.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today we're going to philosophize about cyber activism.
By cyber activism, we mean political activism that's made possible by the use of cyber tools. Things like email, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, podcasts, and so on. The internet is changing everything, practically everything, from the way we work to the way we play. It only stands to reason that it should change the way we engage in social and political action, too.
Yeah, John, think back to the old days. Remember how hard it was to organize a rally before the days of the internet? Yeah, you had to knock on doors, hand out flyers, hang posters all over the place. Well, today, you just need to send out a tweet. It goes viral, and the next thing you know, thousands of people may show up.
Well, in 1968, my wife and I had a home center for Eugene McCarthy. And it was a lot of work. You had to beg people to willing to spend hours on the street corner handing out petitions and getting signatures. And all, of course, to no avail because McCarthy lost.
But, you know, it wasn't just posters and petitions. Let's not forget, there was this thing called TV and radio and print. Those are all forms of mass media. And in their heyday, you do have to admit, each of them had a huge effect on the way we organize and mobilize people.
Yeah, but, you know, those media were top-down, hierarchical. To get your voice heard, you had to be a pretty important person. You had to enjoy the favor of the gatekeepers. You had a lot of money. Somehow you had to force your way onto the scene through money or perhaps mass disruption. Cyberspace is the great leveler. For good or evil, it totally democratizes the way we communicate, organize, and mobilize.
Yeah, well, that's true. Think about if you were trying to get a petition drive in favor of McCarthy. These days, you want to do a petition drive, you don't have to spend lots of money. You don't have to enlist tons of foot soldiers. You just put it up on the internet, which anybody can do. You share the link with your like-minded friends and followers. They share it with their friends and followers. And before you know it, you've got thousands, maybe even millions of people willing to stand up and be counted for the cause.
Right, and McCarthy still loses. But really, Ken, you mean sit down and be counted. This is the most passive kind of activism. Signing an online petition is mostly practiced from the couch.
Yeah, couch potatoes have their right to be heard, too. Don't you think you got something against couch potatoes?
No, but it's not just that I object to. It's they're part of a symptom of a larger disease.
Disease? You're comparing the internet to a disease, John?
Well, like all things in life, it's kind of a mixed blessing.
Oh, come on. Why don't you enlighten me, oh wise one?
Well, the barriers of entry are so low that there are just too many voices vying to be heard. In the old days, it was too hard to be heard. But today, it's too easy. Every voice is amplified, and when every voice is amplified, nothing gets heard.
Do you mean to tell me you want to go back to the old days of the top-down gatekeeper? Surely you just.
Well, those gatekeepers weren't all bad. They filtered out some of the noise. They certified some voices as worthy of our attention. They actually facilitated conversations that were more than a mere cacophony.
Well, but think of these recent police shootings of young black men. Think of the anguish national conversations those things have prompted. Do you really think we'd be having those conversations if it weren't for cell phone cameras everywhere, each one of them connected to the internet, each one of them hooked up to social media, and that social media enabling them to go viral overnight? You think we'd be having those conversations in the good old days?
Yeah, but for every cause that gets a hearing, every important cause, 10 shallow causes of no significance having to do with Justin Bieber or Angela Jolie get a huge hearing, too.
Well, I don't think you've got your percentages exactly right on that one.
Well, how about the issues of truth and reliability? Do you think the ratio of truth and falsehood has been increased or decreased by the internet age?
Well, I have to admit, it's probably been decreased. But, you know, you got to take the good with the bad, John. You can't have everything.
And who does the internet benefit most? Nefarious actors like ISIS or good guys like us with righteous causes?
There you got me again. The jury's still out on that one. The internet enables some pretty ugly people to organize themselves in some pretty ugly ways. I have to admit that, too.
Well, and how about the issue of the big guys versus the little guys? Who gains more from the new way of doing things?
Oh, I got you on that one. It's the little guy. I mean, you said it yourself. The internet is tearing down old power structures. That's certainly true. You and I agree on that one.
Well, it's replacing the old big guys with new big guys. Amazon, Google, Facebook. These are not little guys, Ken, and they're in charge.
There's a lot to consider here, isn't there? You know, I'm not even sure where we should begin on this topic.
Well, like always, we should look at somebody younger and wiser. That's our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari. We sent her out to see how cyber activism has rallied nations and brought about real-world changes. She files this report.
This story kind of hits close to home. You see, I was raised in California, but born in Iran. In 2009, I was long gone, but that's when thousands of people took to the streets in my home country. They were protesting the results of the presidential election, which most thought were rigged. And for the first time in the country's history, the entire world watched. On Twitter, and Facebook, and YouTube. Then in 2011, the same thing happened in Egypt, and then Tunisia, and pretty much every other continent in the world. Anyone with an internet connection or a smartphone got to be a cyber activist. But it wouldn't have worked unless real change happened on the ground, too. Like when CNN didn't immediately cover the Iran protests, a Twitter movement ensued with the hashtag CNNFail. After that, CNN started covering the protests a lot.
That big day of morning rally in Tehran has begun. Information today, a precious commodity there as the Iranian regime cracks down on the release of information.
Then there's clicktivism. The idea is one click of the mouse can make you an activist from the comfort of your own couch. One Stanford graduate loved this model so much that in 2007, he decided to build a clicktivist company, Change.org. I went to their headquarters in San Francisco to see how they work.
Hi, how are you?
It's good. How are you doing?
I met Brianna K. O'Cotter there. She does their PR. She remembers one of their first big campaign successes.
This petition was started by a group of women in Saudi Arabia who were petitioning for the right to drive. And they started a petition to get Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State at the time, to speak out publicly in support of them. And they were successful.
They also succeeded in getting a lot of attention, from international media coverage to really quirky YouTube songs.
No woman, no drive. No woman, no drive.
Change.org also has a lot of luck tackling big business, like Bank of America. A few years ago, a 22-year-old nanny got really angry when her bank tried to add a $5 ATM fee. So she started a petition.
And over the course of a month, she not only gets Bank of America to agree to drop their debit fees, but every other major bank in the United States has petitions that start against them. And at the end of a month, no debit card fees. That, in my mind, kind of signaled the beginning of a wild ride.
Today, over 70 million people in nearly 200 different countries use Change.org's website. Kay O'Connor says their model works because the online petition is only the starting point.
It's a way to rally public support online in a centralized place, but you'll also see actions on the street, petition deliveries to the decision makers, negotiations behind the scenes, lobbying, Facebook groups that pop up around it.
But having a centralized place to organize, the internet, is how they're able to get 25,000 new petitions started up each month.
We're trying to use technology to enable people everywhere to create change about what they want to see in the world. And it's amazing what happens when you allow people to do that.
Cyber activism is the digital version of old school activism. Signing a petition or sharing a Facebook post can lead to social change, whether it's a revolution in the Middle East or getting $5 back from your bank. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for that introduction to contemporary cyber activism. I'm John Perry. I'm here along with my fellow philosopher, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Our guest today is a visiting scholar at the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. She's co-author of Disrupting Philanthropy, Technology and the Future of the Social Sector. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Lucy Bernholtz.
Welcome.
Welcome, Lucy.
Thank you.
Lucy, the disruptive power of the internet and other digital technologies is no doubt a fascinating thing. We're all a little bit interested, but you're a lot interested. What got you thinking about this topic?
I have a lot of siblings and a lot of first cousins, so I spent a lot of my childhood surrounded by age peers, which leads to one question: what's mine and what's yours and who decides? Mm-hmm. So you grow up a little bit, that question becomes what's private, what's public, and who decides? 1994 or so, World Wide Web comes along, it's new, I'm naive. I actually read those terms of service and privacy policy. Yeah, I'm the one.
Gosh.
And they worry me. There's not much in there about my privacy. So that was the beginning of this journey.
Wow, you read the whole thing. What is it? How's it? I mean, if you download it, how many pages is it?
It's a lot.
Oh, about 27. It depends on whose, but yeah, 9.
Now, Ken over here, he's a real gung-ho technology guy. He's never met a new technology he didn't like. He's looking forward to space travel and calling home with his iPhone from Mars. I just tend to see mixed blessings everywhere. I've got my typewriter and an iPhone 3, and that's about as modern as I want to get. It's an electric typewriter. You are obviously someone who's deeply interested in issues of harnessing technology for social change and social progress, and not harnessing technology for social retrogression. So what's your kind of overview before we get into the details, the overview of the current state of the internet? Freedom, privacy, a blessing, a curse, something in between? What's going on?
Well, I think the tools themselves are a blessing. I think, as Shuka showed, there's no denying the access people have now and the ability to both put their voice out there, but also check the voices of others. So the technology, I think, is a good thing. I think we've learned some pretty bad habits, and we need to check those habits.
Bad habits, expand. What bad?
Well, so I know you asked the audience to turn off their cell phones, right? But I know, first of all, they all have them. Probably everybody's got about 1,000 photos on those cell phones, and they're all location tracking devices, right? The 1,000 photos means nobody can find any photo they want, right? With data storage has become so cheap, we keep everything. You wouldn't keep all the information you had about all your friends and family and bad things you've done.
The
location tracking device is a little tricky.
It means somebody knows you're right here, right
exactly.
Now,
but
thing is on.
That's
surely in those 29 pages, were they from Apple or Google or Facebook? They must have had some reassuring things in there.
No, they're not privacy policy. They're not interested in me. They're interested in what they can use with my data. They shouldn't be called privacy policies. They should be called what we're going to do with your data policies.
And when you click on that agreement, you're saying, yeah, do all this stuff, which I didn't read that you're going to do and don't
exactly
have any
right. You know what the biggest lie on the internet is, don't you?
No.
I agree.
Ah.
So they could have in there that they were going to take my firstborn, and I would probably have agreed to it 20 or 30 times this week. Yeah.
You might want to look at that again and talk to your kids.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater. Our guest is Lucy Bernholtz from the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. We're philosophizing together about cyber activism.
Have the tools of cyberspace done more harm than good? Have they empowered the little guy? Or have they just enriched the big guy? Have they broken down the old hierarchies? Or merely replaced them with new ones?
Progress, disruption, and the cyber age. Along with questions from our live, or is it virtual, audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
So much for the electronic brains that run the world of banks and aeroplanes. And if one little mouse can set them all awry, why not you and I?
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Lucy Bernholtz, co-author of Disrupting Philanthropy, Technology, and the Future of the Social Sector. And we're philosophizing together today about cyber activism.
When all voices are amplified, can any voice be really heard? Has the internet encouraged conversation or merely allowed cacophony? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone. And we'll take you one at a time so we don't have cacophony.
So, Lucy, in this segment, we want to dig into the real potential and also the real pitfalls that you were talking about a little bit ago for social and political activism in the age of the internet. But I want to start with the upside rather than the downside. So tell me, what's the single biggest difference between the post-internet era that we're now in and the pre-internet era in how we communicate, organize, and mobilize?
I think the biggest difference is that everybody can be a change maker. Everybody can be that catalyst. Everybody can try to post a petition, as you mentioned. They then have to do the hard work of making it viral. It's not quite magic from post to change. In fact, that middle part is very complicated. But the access to the internet and mobile and digital technologies at least gives all of us a chance to get in there.
So that thing that you said, that the middle part is really complicated and hard and challenging.
Yeah.
Do you think people are aware of that? I mean, I think there's a meme going around that the internet has democratized everything. Well, it may have democratized the first entry point, but that middle uptake point between entry and...
I'm not even sure it's democratized. I'm not even sure that's the right word. It's made it available. There's still a lot of things standing between a lot of people and even that availability. But what it has done is the cost of taking that first step are so low that, in fact, you might never get off your couch.
Yeah, but wait, I think I heard you talking about that. Didn't some people from the couch, there was over Super Bowl. Tell me that story again.
So
that was couch activism.
That was couch activism, but it was loosely coordinated couch activism.
Tell us about it.
So here's what happened. In 2012... Planned Parenthood, the Susan G. Komen Foundation, which is a not-for-profit organization with a board of directors and a set of rules, and it follows those rules and it does those things and has hundreds of thousands of people who support it. They made a decision within the rules of nonprofits to stop funding to Planned Parenthood.
Right. That was highly controversial.
Highly controversial and absolutely infuriated many of the people Komen Foundation assumed cared about the Komen Foundation. Well, the people who heard about this and disagreed with the decision took to Twitter and actually also used major broadcast television. What they did was actually hacked the hashtag that was being used for this small TV event you might have heard of. It's called the Super Bowl.
Yeah, right.
Right. So Komen had worked with the NFL and created a hashtag for the Super Bowl. And these folks who, you know, first connected via their own email accounts and Twitter and said sort of, you know, this is outrageous, this shouldn't happen, well, let's do something. Okay, so from wherever they were, they took the hashtag that Komen and the NFL had paid for and put money into advertising, and they hacked it. Every time anybody clicked or used that hashtag, they were redirected to a different website that said, take back the pink. This was just one thing. It was about 8 people or so behind it.
Right.
Although by the time halftime rolled around,
yeah, right,
the official hashtag had been hacked every single time. So hundreds of thousands of people got involved in this. There were a bunch of other parallel activities.
8 upset people, right?
8 upset people.
Started this, and it turned into 100 thousands of people protesting
during the Super Bowl.
Yeah. And that was all from the couch.
Now, I of course understand everything you said, but some of our radio listeners are okay. Old people that may not really know what a hashtag is. So, I mean, I know what it looks like,
right.
But what do you do with a hashtag?
Okay, what you do with a hashtag? First of all, it's that weird little pound sign on your telephone. It's even the one, not the ones that go around like this, mm-hmm. but the ones where you press the buttons have a pound sign. When Twitter first launched, somebody came up with an idea of using that little typographical symbol to say, I'm having a conversation about something.
Right.
Oh.
So I'm having a conversation on Philosophy Talk would have that little symbol and then hashtag philosophy talk. And then anyone else looking through Twitter, right. This is a Twitter thing, although it's kind of fiddled around and gone to the other platforms, knows that that's where you go for a conversation about philosophy.
It's a way of indexing the conversation.
Right.
So do they
Black
just type
Lives
in,
Matter,
they just type in hashtag philosophy talk
exactly.
and they're taken there?
Yeah.
And
right.
then everything that has that hashtag philosophy talk, hashtag Black Lives Matter in it gets curated in one place.
So if all these people start putting hashtag philosophy talk on all our Twitter messages,
you'll break the internet.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
but some people hacked that, converted that hashtag
That's right.
to something more. And that was activism.
That was activism. Well, it was only, it's sitting on your couch, watching a football game, drinking beer, and pressing a button. What happened was enough people got involved in caring about the issue that they were eventually able to make Komen Foundation change its policy.
So you said you're not sure that, I said, it's democratized. You said you're not sure about that. Why not? Why would you resist the characterization that the internet has democratized the access to the means of organization mobilization and, you know?
It has brought the cost way down. I'm not sure. You're the philosophers. I'm just a mere historian. I'm not sure if just bringing the cost way down is the exact same thing as democratic access, because you still actually need to be able to get onto the internet. You need some kind of device. You need to deal with the internet company.
So people talk about the digital haves and have nots.
Yes.
Do you think that's a serious thing, the digital haves
and haves? Oh, it's a huge thing. Yeah, of course it is. There's still parts of this country. You don't have to leave the U.S., folks. You can go to parts of Manhattan, and folks can't afford Wi-Fi access. Where are they getting it? Thank goodness they're actually getting it from public libraries. But, you know, public libraries actually close at night, and sometimes they turn their routers off.
So you think has this thing become so vital, these digital technologies, so vital to our public life, that you can't be a full participant in the public discourse and public life unless you have access to these things? So should we enshrine into the law or into the Constitution the right of equal access to digital tools?
There's a discussion of that. There are folks who are arguing that information access is a human right and it should be a civil right.
What do you think?
I think it's not quite a human right. I think it's information access. This country, we've already enshrined into our Constitution that there should be free press and free speech, and we should make sure that the tools of today are accessible the way the tools of tomorrow are. Because, by the way, whatever it is we're using today, we're going to be using something else in 5 years.
Right.
So we need to keep that in mind.
Well, there's this current debate going on about 2 tiers of use and so forth.
Net neutrality.
Is that a crucial issue?
That's a crucial issue, because that's taking the system that we've already paid for.
Mm-hmm.
We, the citizens and taxpayers who put in a lot of the infrastructure, or the cities and states have signed over the rights to companies to build this stuff. And it's now saying, well, pay us a little more and we'll make your stuff go faster,
mm-hmm.
which means, you know, the latest Netflix streaming video is going to go faster than Philosophy Talk is going to stream.
What?
I think. I know. It's outrageous.
Those are new gatekeepers. There's a new gatekeeper.
Absolutely.
Who are we going to pay? We're going to pay the government? Who's going to be the gatekeeper to whether you get the fast lane or the slow lane?
You're going
to
pay Comcast.
Comcast
and AT&T. Comcast, AT&T, so your telecom companies, your cable companies, and your internet service providers. They're the new gatekeepers.
Well, that's frightening. So look, Comcast and AT&T, that brings another thing to mind. I said in the opening, you know, we're breaking down these old authorities. And I think that is certainly true. I mean, In my field, the academic publishers, they're having a heck of a time. I mean, they're trying to figure out ways to make it come back, but it's not coming back. It's a brave new world. John said, I think rightly, but yeah, we broke down the old authorities, but there's a whole bunch of new authorities sneaking up, especially people that started out as small guys are now big. I want to ask you, as a person who wants to be use the internet and digital for a social change, do you fear the government more, or do you feel Facebook, Google, et cetera, more?
They both need to be feared. We need to understand that both of them occupy the territory, the digital space, that the activists are trying to use for their cause. So that's like taking your protest and holding it in corporate America's house or in the government's house. So if you're going to do that, and there's good reason to do it in some cases, but if you're going to do it, you better understand that that's what you're doing and adjust your tactics accordingly.
You said there's good reason to do it in some cases. Is there any alternative? Is there any other place to use these digital technologies except in the house of the government and the house of the corporations? Is there some other space?
The space, the waves, the technological stuff that moves all the data around, you can get on there without going through these ISPs and using the mass media, the Facebooks and the Twitters. And activists are. If you look at Facebook and you say to yourself, gosh, there aren't any human rights activists here, it's not because there aren't any human rights activists using digital media. Right. It's because they're not dumb enough to use Facebook.
Like change.org.
They're creating their own platforms, they're creating phones, they're recoding the software so that it doesn't track their locations. They're recoding it so it doesn't store the information that they're exchanging on somebody else's servers so they can use it safely.
So in terms of philosophical issues, you've got these places like Google and Facebook. They're corporations. They have rights of free speech and so forth and so on. Then we have privacy rights. Now, my understanding is that in Europe, there's quite a bit of consternation about how people's privacy rights are being interfered with by the way these companies operate. We don't seem to be worried about that. Can you shed some light on that, what the values and what the policies are there?
Well, I can shed some light on the values, a little bit on the policies. I mean, the U.S. has given us and enshrined in the First Amendment the right to free speech. The European approach to speech is different. There isn't a First Amendment for free speech in any of the countries in Europe or for the European Union. And in addition, there's also a protective policy and a value put on privacy. It comes out of post-World War II experiences of most of the countries in Eastern and Western Europe recognizing that there's a legitimate right to privacy. We don't have that one enshrined the way they do. So here you've got these companies that are inherently global, and they need to be able to fit into both of those policies. There's a third level, too, which is where we started this in the terms of service. When you sign on to that, or when you click through, I should say, on that 28-page document that you didn't read, you are not, by the way, clicking on the First Amendment, even if you're doing it from this country. You're clicking on terms of service that dictate, they're going to define what you can say and what you cannot. So we've got all these conflicting levels of policy at work for companies that have to work globally, and then we bring our own national and cultural values to that.
Google and all those, they're upset at the Europeans. What is it exactly that they're upset at the Europeans? They did something that I don't quite understand.
Well, they've done a lot of things that have upset a lot of people, but there's two things at play at large. One is they created something called the right to be forgotten, which is completely out of sync with our idea of free speech, right? So if somebody says something about you, John, and I know this is unlikely, but if something about you that you don't like, and it was captured digitally on the internet, under the right to be forgotten, it's a little more complicated than this, but to simplify it, you actually have a right to contest it and try to get it literally taken down off the internet. Now, that's not something that we can understand in a free speech situation, because who are the first people who are going to try to make that happen? A few politicians, perhaps.
A lot of politicians.
Right?
I have a right to hire a lawyer at some fee I can't afford to hire you for slander, and he'd probably lose.
Right.
That's it.
That's right. So there's a right to be forgotten. Now, not only, here's another kind of example of the craziness we're living in right now. This is an EU law. Guess who the enforcers of it are? Google.
Right.
They've said the companies need to take this stuff down.
Right.
So it's it's we have, you know, outsourced public responsibility that doesn't cross national lines. We need to invent some new rules.
Let's get some questions from our live audience. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about cyber activism in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We've got some questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question? First, tell us who you are and where you're from, and then your comment or question.
Thank you. I'm Philip, San Francisco. My question has to do with your initial impressions in 94, reading that document, the terms of agreement. And I'm curious about the period of time that most of us lived through from 94 through 2000. And then as they shifted, what was your experience and they, meaning the rules of agreement, what you sign off on?
So basically, the point of the story was to say that here's this document being presented to me for this new thing, this World Wide Web that was as new to me as it was to everybody else in the room. It was called a Terms of Agreement or a Privacy Policy. There's very little in it, even then, about protect what I read as being about my privacy, that like my conversations, my communication was going to be mine, which is my definition of both ownership and privacy. Over time, all of us who've lived here, all of you who are on Facebook, have seen them change those rules. And typically, the experience has been we're going to change the rules and see if you get mad. And if you get mad enough, we'll just take it, usually, depending on which company we're talking about, and we'll just keep pushing that. So, of course, you as a user have have a choice here. You can just say, no, I'm not going to play by those rules. I'm not going to use that. And I think what's happened, two very obvious things have happened. A lot of other tools have come along, and people have chosen or not chosen to use them. But I think the scariest thing that's happened is the degree to which we've just habituated ourselves to thinking that those choices are the only choices.
Right, right. I think we don't think enough about what they're up to. We think about what it enables us to do.
Right.
But we think very, very little about what are they doing with all this stuff that they're gathering. And as you start to think about it, it gets to be kind of astounding and frightening. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about cyber activism with Lucy Bernholtz from the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society.
In our final segment, we'll examine how the tools of cyberspace can be improved to better service. How can we make sure these tools actually advance the social good and diminish the gulf between the digital haves and the digital have-nots?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Just admit it, I should have flown with someone else or gone by car. 'Cause United breaks guitars. Yeah, United breaks guitars.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about cyber activism with our guest, Lucy Bernholtz, co-author of Disrupting Philanthropy, Technology and the Future of the Social Sector. We're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater, and we've got lots of questions from that audience. I'm going to start this side and go back and forth. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am. Tell us who you are and where you're from and your comment or question.
Thank you very much. My name is Catherine, and I live here in San Francisco. And my question is, what are your feelings on people who use the internet to try and break it?
To break the internet itself.
To break the internet.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, that's another example of how the digital environment has infiltrated our lives, is that, in fact, it's not just activism with the internet, it's activism against the internet.
Yeah.
There's lots of points of view on this. There's a lot of activism about the government surveillance of the internet. There's activism and concern about the corporate control of everything that travels through their equipment. And then there's a sense that, in fact, if you can take down websites, that itself is an active protest.
Are people trying to break the internet? I don't know who these people are who are trying to break the internet. If one thought that the internet has just turned into another tool of the old power hierarchy, And it's false advertising that it's, you know, democratizing everything. It's just replacing old authority structures. Right. Then one might well set out to break it as a, because it's just a tool of domination. Is that what's behind that kind of thing?
I think that's right, because the kind of mindset for the original, or the original public version of the internet, was this very decentralized, equal access, all data traveled the same, anyone could upload, anyone could download, and particularly not just in the internet itself, the World Wide Web is a subset of the internet, so it's not the whole thing, but most importantly, those devices we've got in our pockets with, that use the apps, that environment is like a very small slice of this whole thing called the internet. And the sense is that the corporate powers that are creating those tools are deliberately trying to keep us in their backyard and don't want us to have access.
So take the people trying to break the internet, take the people trying to use the internet for good, take the corporations, but there's also another. There is a one of the things that the internet does, it lets people organize themselves.
That's right.
It's morally indifferent, though. So the good people and the bad people. I mean, has this, is the benefit of what the good people can do, whoever you think the good people are, does it outweigh the benefits of what the bad people can do? Does it help one more than the other?
Well, I don't know. Are there more good people or bad people out there?
I don't know.
But right? you're at the Center for Philanthropy and Other Stuff.
Right.
So are philanthropic organizations, who I think of the do-gooders of the world, are they taking advantage of the internet the way they should?
No, they're not doing anywhere near enough, actually. And I think they, like many of us, are habituated to the default settings, if you will, that corporate America has given us, corporate globe has given us, and governments have given us. So we all need to get smarter about this and recognize that we need to use the settings of the digital age, the way that environment works, and recognize that it's not the analog material. It's not the First Amendment. It's not freedom of from surveillance. And since it's not those things, what choices do we have? Well, we can try to change the rules about that. That is good old political and social activism for you. And we can actually change the way we work in those spaces. So you see groups creating their own tools.
Yeah, right.
And you see groups saying, you know what? So here, back to my photo analogy earlier. If I have all that data on everybody who comes through my nonprofit, or everybody my foundation funds, if I keep all that data, I'm liable for it. I got to protect it. I can be subpoenaed for it. I might be putting people in danger. So you know what? I won't collect it. There's a choice.
More questions from our audience. Welcome to Fluffy Talk, man.
Kristen from San Francisco. And the question is about how we think about traditional versus new media. So CNN or traditional newspapers, we hold a very high standard to be unbiased and fair. But people are getting their media sources from Facebook, Twitter, Instagram now. But we're not really looking at the algorithms behind how they show us and what they show us. Should we be? Yeah. Will we be?
Oh, God.
Yeah. So there's actually the new director of technology for the FTC has said he cares deeply about ethical and visible algorithms. So this is actually coming to light, which is kind of incredible. So, you know, here's a word that's like hashtag, right? I mean, who wants to talk? I'm a historian. Why am I talking about algorithms? It's not just that so much of our data has been stored. It's that decisions are being made using mathematical equations that, you know, assign a certain value to certain kinds of data. And this is driving policing, housing policy, credit policy, sure, it's everywhere. So yeah, do we need to understand how those decisions are made? Yes.
I gotta tell you, there is all kinds of stuff going on beneath the hood that we don't know about. And I think, I don't know if we have a right to, but it would sure be good if we could make this more transparent.
Right. Well, do we have an enshrined right? No, but do we have a democratic value at stake here? This is a new form of power, and democracy works when we can subject power to scrutiny. And it's a new kind of power.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to Philosophy Talks, sir.
Yes, I'm Dan from San Francisco. Briefly, we talked earlier about the Target and so forth. And with, of course, the very public Sony break-in recently, right. And that's incredibly massive. And it seems we have so many of these that my question is privacy over? Given that it seems that the bad guys, anyone who wants to break in with the right skill set can do so, are we going to have to change our notions of privacy?
No, we should change our behaviors. Privacy is another word for liberty and freedom. So if it's over, we got a really big problem here. The folks who are telling us that privacy is over, for the most part, have a vested interest in telling us that privacy is over. They are running corporations that want you to keep exchanging your social security number. And it doesn't, you don't even have to put the particular, that particular type of obviously sensitive data on there. There's so much information about each of us out there that they're triangulating this information. What we need to be aware of is the value exchange we're making for that. And if you value one-day free shipping or two-day free shipping, then that's okay. But if you value freedom and your own personal information, and that's not what you want to do, there's plenty of options for you to still be able to communicate with a lot of people, but don't consent to those terms
of
service.
But you know what? You say we need to change our behavior, but I'm afraid that ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
And because of the following, I have a 17-year-old son. I love him to death. He doesn't do much Facebooking, but he texts his friends constantly.
Right.
Some of his friends tweet constantly. Yeah. Some of his friends use Facebook. They live their lives
right
in public. They don't understand what privacy is. They've lost a certain kind of political ethos. That's gone. It's just completely gone in certain generations of Americans, I believe.
I don't think it's gone. I think it looks different. So you've got a teenager. I've got a teenager. Here's one thing we both know. When they're talking to their friends in a language that we don't understand,
yeah, well, that's right.
That's on purpose.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
code. It's code.
Yeah.
They're encrypting it.
But
in
they're
some
doing
way.
It on these devices
yes.
and in these structures that are not private devices or private structures.
Right. Know? But for the most part, the kids are smarter than we are about this stuff. They are, in fact, aware. They've got fake Facebook pages. They need to experience a consequence, right? Then
right.
they get it.
Right.
And the consequence that matters for most kids of that age is either being shunned by their peers or not getting to go where they want to go. And
you know, I may be naive, but Thomas Jefferson said that we needed a revolution every 25 years. The NRA thinks that's why we should have guns. But I doubt if that's what in his more thoughtful moments he meant. We have this we have this amendment process, and it used to be used fairly frequently to solve problems. And sometimes, like prohibition. I mean, why did prohibition go into effect? Well, because a lot of people wanted it. And then it went out of effect. Why? Because it didn't work. It's a process that needs to be used every 25 years to face up to the way things have changed. We ought to have some amendments, to face up to the fact that our Congress is bought and sold by big corporations. We ought to have some amendments that face up to the fact that the Supreme Court has destroyed the meaning of the word person. And we ought to have some amendments that reflect that privacy isn't something you could take for granted like you could in the days when you just moved west and nobody knew who you were.
Right.
It's a new world. So
You're
we
right,
ought
John.
To sit up and do something
John,
about it.
John, you have to start tweeting.
Well, I've been waiting.
There's a revolution waiting for you.
I've been waiting to find out what a hashtag is, and now that I know.
So let's take one last question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Susan from San Francisco. I want to hear about how we avoid having our data collected. What it seems like there are these mysterious experts who know how to create their own ISPs, but for Luddites, what do we do?
So there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, the important thing is to keep letting the companies and the government know that we care about this. Apple is marketing its newest devices, which I'm sure you're going to upgrade to, saying that they protect your data better than the other guys. Mm-hmm. So this message has been received, at least somehow, by some of these folks. For the rest of us who can't code our way out of a paper bag, which includes me, there are off-the-shelf, off-the-internet tools you can use that encrypt your email. If you look up in the upper right-hand corner of your web browser, which is that thing you use to get onto the internet, there should be some encryption message up there. If not, change your web browser. There's a growing number of not-for-profit organizations that are trying to take the more complicated versions of software that protects your individual privacy and make it customer friendly.
One last thing though, you said the Apple's newest device, that's that Apple Watch thing, right? Which is gonna gather all this information about your health.
Right.
They may not let anybody, they may protect it, but I think they're probably gonna sell it and distribute it.
Yeah, so I mean, remember what their motives are, right? And go looking through those privacy policies. So the Apple Watch is extraordinary. If you look through it, and they advertised it about, you know, we're not going to be selling your data and only you will have your data. But if you actually go to see what they put in writing that they're going to hold themselves accountable to, it says your data will only be made available for medical research, period.
Yeah.
Medical research by whom? Nike?
Yeah. I bet.
Wow.
I put my Apple Watch on one day and I start getting Viagra ads the next day.
It's not going to take a day.
Lucy, this has been quite an interesting conversation. We're just scratching the surface, but I got to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Lucy Bernholtz, visiting scholar at Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society, co-author of Disrupting Philanthropy, Technology, and the Future of the Social Sector. So, John, what are you thinking now? You want to share your thoughts? You want to keep them private?
Hashtag too much change. Hashtag too much bother. Hashtag I'm tired of learning new things. Yeah. Hashtag I'm really tired of small print.
Yeah. But, you know, I think you're right. The amendment process, you think? I think people have to stand up and say, what kind of society do we want? And we have to enforce those constraints on our society through the democratic process. This is a big deal. It's a really big deal.
We need to get people like your son, who I know has a social active conscience and understands the internet, to really be concerned with this. So it's your problem.
There you go. Well, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from a clicktivist for speed. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, in the fall of 2014, a nurse returning from working with Ebola patients in Africa was retained in New Jersey at the behest of the governor and was supposed to be kept in a tent for a month. She left the tent in a huff. A column by conservative Wesley Pruden in the online Washington Times referenced this, saying, quote, Casey Hickox, the nurse who was freed from the New Jersey quarantine, complained that her isolation was inhumane. And we have to be very, very careful about letting politicians make health decisions. She has hired a lawyer, naturally, unquote. Most of the column was about Obama's alleged incompetence around Ebola. How Obama, well, I don't know, it seems silly now. Anybody out there in America still scared of Ebola? No? Obama saved us! 3 cheers for Obama! Oh, sit down. Oh, by the way, how come nobody blamed Governor Rick Perry for the guy who died of Ebola in Texas? This kind of all got my goat, I must say. The consensus among conservatives about Casey Hickox seemed to be, how dare she know better about her own health than the governor of New Jersey? If the governor of New Jersey says you have to live in a tent for a month, get in your hospital gown and shut up. Now, trolling down to the comments, I was appalled. Tracy Hickox was called arrogant. In a fit of pique, I commented, quote, the nurse who was quarantined, Casey Hickox, did not have Ebola. She should sue everybody, including you. Maybe we learn to shut up until we have our facts straight, unquote. Well, golly, did I catch it. One commenter asked me what I would do if my daughter was riding a subway with this nurse. This was highly unlikely, but since the nurse did not have Ebola, I said it would be fine with me. Another commenter addressed me as champ and said that since the PCR test is inconclusive, I should stick to my own advice. That is, I guess, shut up. I responded quite snarkily, I must confess. If she started vomiting blood, boy, would my face be red. At this, the champ guy bombarded me with links to Wikipedia articles about gestation periods of various diseases and whatnot. I responded by asking him, oh yeah? Do you know the difference between a real quarantine and a politician-induced panic? And then he said, do you understand the difference between honestly answering a question and deflection? Oh, he had me. I was an equivocating weasel. So I wrote, I deflect to your greater internet commenting expertise and knowledge of Ebola incubation periods, and quietly backed away, my neck still intact. But I followed the comments, which went on to say Casey's tantrum, as one put it, was coordinated by Obama and the CDC, for whom she secretly worked, and the evidence scrubbed from her LinkedIn account. I bit my tongue virtually. Anyway, after a couple hundred comments, I finally read, where is the troll Ian? How many people put him in his place and he has to go look all over the internet for more liberal responses? Wow, he thinks I'm a troll. And then I realized I was a troll. I had invaded the Washington Times and Wesley Pruden and the sacred comment space to wade in among legions of people who are there only to support him and all his opinionizing. It was a pure process and I had muddied it up. I felt terrible. My only consolation was that history had absolved me. Casey did not, in fact, have Ebola. But anyway, my lips are sealed. No more trolling. I've learned a valuable lesson. Until I know what I'm talking about, I will keep my big mouth shut. Present circumstances excluded, of course. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Marie Cartier, Or Gozal, Kiyuzad Aya, Dan Brandon, and Crystal Nickerson.
Our program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research, and our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
Now, the views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.